We're going to continue our study of Leviticus tonight. If you'd like to open your Bibles to that particular book, we'll take a look at Leviticus, beginning with chapter 11. Leviticus chapter 11. And we're going to deal with some very old rules and regulations that are associated with Jewish people that in many ways continue even to today in their observance, their what we would typically call kosher lifestyles. The first 10 chapters that we've looked at previously have dealt with the issue of God instructing his people on how he would have them worship him in spirit and truth. And beginning with chapter 11, where we are at in our text tonight, we're seeing that God's focus now is going to shift on not how we worship him, but how we walk before him. And we're going to deal with some various issues of illnesses and the prohibitions, the dietary restrictions and stuff. And many of you are probably familiar with a classic work that was done several years ago called None of Those These Diseases, which shows how by following the dietary regulations of the Jews in the Old Testament, that a lot of the things that plagued Egypt, and I pun intended, but a lot of the issues that health things that Egypt dealt with, the Israelites were protected from through their dietary laws. You may be familiar with the plague of the bubonic plague of the Middle Ages, and how up to one third of all of Europe was killed in a relatively short time through it. And yet, the Jews living in their segregated cultures and following their very weird and meticulous dietary restrictions were, for the most part, preserved from it. To the degree that the Gentiles living in these European villages thought that it was actually caused by the Jews, since so few of them received any kind of affliction from it. And as is often the case, they dealt with a lot of persecution. The Egyptians, and remember, these people are fresh out of Egypt. They have just left and are there in the wilderness, and God is doing a new thing. Everything with them is, I mean, this is like kindergarten. He's trying to teach them backing up and starting over. And all they knew before, their total realm of experience had been through the Egyptians. And the Egyptians, even though for their day and age were very advanced in their medicine, in fact, many potentates from around the world would petition Pharaoh to send some of his physicians to come to them to treat some of their ailments. And yet, when we look at what they were actually teaching as science in those days, they believed that most illnesses were the result of demonic possession of some kind, that you had, you know, some sort of demon of 103 degree fever or some sort of demon of spots all over your face or some sort of whatever it was. And so they believed that the best way of treating these demons was to mix up a concoction, some sort of an elixir that was so foul-smelling and so foul-tasting that when you would imbibe, the demon couldn't hang around anymore. I mean, it just like hold its nose and run for the hills sort of thing. And that was the way they treated most diseases. There was a papyrus found, I think it was around about 100 years ago, turn of the last century, by a guy named Edwin Smith. And he found this papyrus that shows a lot of what they learned in, or what their beliefs were of their medicine of the day. And this is their prescription for the treatment of baldness. They say that you take the fat of lion, the fat of hippo, the fat of cat, fat of crocodile, and the fat of ibex, and the fat of serpent. So these four different five different critters, you take the fat from them, and then mix them together, and the head of the bald person is anointed with them. And so that was their science. Almost every kind of salve or medicine that they would concoct had some sort of, by design, there would be some sort of animal feces added to it, animal dung, and or some kind of mold that they would cultivate. And so even though there may have been some healing qualities to some of the stuff they did, of course the infections and the other side effects were so much worse than the cure. And this is the element that God is inserting his dietary laws into. You know, the Israelites had grown up thinking these sort of things were just not old wives' tales or some sort of a very prehistoric kind of dealing with medicine, but this was the cutting edge. This was major stuff. And then God comes into the picture with his restrictions, and he's doing something quite a bit different, some of which seems to be arbitrary, many things that we can't connect the dots of the cause and effect, but it was God's instructions nonetheless. A lot of these things we have learned since. What the health benefits of those various restrictions would have been, especially for that day and age and place, but some of which we don't know even to today, but we can trust that it wasn't arbitrary on God's part. The dietary laws, as I said, kept the Jews separate, which that was kind of the purpose of them, to be a separate people. He says in the text and many other places in Scripture, be holy even as I am holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And their dietary laws kept them separate, and also kept them healthy in many ways. And I think the early church understood this. You know, the first Christians, of course, were from this culture, from the Jewish culture. They had kept kosher, kept these dietary restrictions. And we, in Acts chapter 15, where they were dealing with, okay, now a bunch of Gentiles were getting saved. Do they need to become Jews? Because the early church was all Jews. And so, you know, we had to get circumcised. How come those guys don't have to get circumcised was kind of the question. And as they bandied about trying to decide what was the best thing for it, James, the Lord's half-brother, who was at that time the pastor of the church of Jerusalem, he issued the decree. He asked the other disciples who were there, how come we would want to impose a yoke on the Gentiles of rules and regulations and restrictions that we ourselves weren't able to bear? And so he says in Acts chapter 15, when they had this big church council, in verse 29, he says, just tell them to abstain from things offered to idol, from blood, and from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. If you keep these things, then you're going to be okay. And it wasn't that he was saying, okay, we can't give them a bunch of rules and regulations, so we're just going to give them two. You know, avoid things that have been, keep the dietary laws and flee from sexual immorality. But he's not saying that. He's not giving them some sort of law. He's not giving them some regulations here. He's simply saying to the Gentiles, because these were the things that separated the Jews from their pagan neighbors. And so he's telling the Gentile Christians, be separate. Be holy because the Lord your God is holy. And with every element of Christian grace, everything that we see as far as the New Testament comes along and starts showing a new thing and starts teaching us a new way of relating to God, and it, with every element of that, you know, we are not under the law, we're under grace, we will often at times quote Paul. But every element of the Christian grace, we need to understand that the principles and precepts of the Old Testament are elevated to the nth degree. Jesus brought this out very clearly in the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard it said, but I say. And he would take hating to the level of murder, and he would take lusting to the level of adultery. He would elevate all of these Old Testament precepts to the nth degree. So with that in mind, I think that's what Paul had in mind when he wrote to the church of Corinth in 1 Corinthians 10:31. That he says, so whatever you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. You know, it's not a matter of, okay, you can eat this kind of food and you can't eat that kind of food. That was made very clear in Acts chapter 10. When the gospel was extended to the Gentiles. Paul said, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about prohibitions. I mean, for me as a Christian, I had the freedom to eat anything that's on this prohibited list in chapters 10 and 11 and 12. I have the freedom to do that. But Paul says, whatever you do, do it to the glory of God. If you can do it to the glory of God, then go for it. Now, chapter 11 teaches us, he is explaining to the Jews the things that would make them unclean based upon what they did. You know, in chapter 12, he's going to talk about the fact that they're unclean based upon who they are. But in chapter 11, it's regarding the things that they would do. And so the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals which divides the cud, having cloven hooves and chewing the cud, that you may eat. Nevertheless, you shall not eat the among those who chew the cud or those who have cloven hooves. The animal, because it chews the cud and does not have cloven hooves, is unclean to you. So the two things about the animals that they would eat, they had to chew the cud and they had to have a cloven hoof. So if it didn't, it couldn't be one or the other, it had to be both. And he gives a camel as an example of that. In different parts of the world, people eat camel burgers. But he says you can't do that with them because even though they chew the cud in much the same way that a cow would, they don't have a cloven hoof, and so like a cow does. And so you can't do it. Now, if we were going to spiritualize this, and many people really like to take the book of Leviticus and spiritualize it, and I think that's good to a point. You know, I think if we can push the envelope too far sometimes and kind of miss the lesson and the application from it. But I think in this regard, those two points that he makes out about the animals you can eat, the chewing the cud, I think, speaks very clearly of ruminating on the Word of God. You know, as a cow eats the grass and then it chews it and it swallows it for a little bit and then it regurgitates it and then it chews on it some more and then it swallows it and then it regurgitates it again and it keeps going over the same food. And as we approach the Word, you know, we can use the word meditate, except it's so politically incorrect these days, but we can talk about meditating. We can medicate on it too, but as we meditate on the Word of God and we just kind of ruminate, we just chew it over and over again, and I think chewing the cud would speak to that. And the cloven hoof, this might be pushing the application a little too far, but it kind of helps me remember what kind of animals they could eat and what they couldn't, because I can remember, okay, chewing the cud, that's ruminating on the Word, and the cloven hoof is having a separated life. As their hooves were separated, then we are told to have separated lives, holy lives, set apart for the Lord. And he says, so you can't eat the camels. In verse 5, he says, or the rocks, hyrax, because it chews the cud but does not have cloven hooves. It is unclean to you. And you think, what the heck's a rock hyrax? Well, these are these little critters that you find all over Israel. If you go over there today from the north up in Galilee, even into the Golan Heights, all the way south down to the Dead Sea desert area, you'll see these guys. And they're kind of like a big gerbil kind of a thing, you know, they're just a big rat rodent. And some commentaries I read said that internally, if you could look at their innards, they're made more like a horse than they are, some other kind of the rodent family. I'm not sure what that means, you know, I don't know. I mean, inside they just kind of look like animals, I think, just like anything else, but that's what the science guys say. Your Bible may call them a rock badger, or I think it's the old King James calls them a coney. And these, he says, chew the cud, but don't have the split hoof, so you don't eat them. And then it says, or the hare, because it chews the cud, but does not have cloven hooves. It is unclean to you. Now, you say, well, I didn't know hares, rabbits chewed the cud. And this was a kind of a source of consternation for commentators for many years. They would read this, and they would think, well, rabbits don't chew their cud. In fact, the critics would say, it shows you how much God knows. You know, he says rabbits chew their cud, and they don't chew their cud. And so the old commentators, if you read like one of the Puritan fathers or somebody from that era, and they would commentate on this verse, they would say that, well, if you ever watch a rabbit, they always make that motion with their, looks like their mouth's always moving. And so it's just they appear to be chewing their cud, and that was the explanation that they would often give. That's fine, but that's not what's being said here. It doesn't say if they appear to chew the cud. It says they chew their cud, but they don't have cloven hooves. And actually, scientists found out a little over 100 years ago, again, about the turn of the century, into the 20th century, that when, must have been a pretty slow day at the lab is all I can say, because as they looked at the rabbit pellets, as they eliminated their pellets, they noticed that they would actually eliminate two different kinds. One would be just good old number two, and the other one would be kind of like a partially digested pellet that was wrapped in this mucus kind of a sack that was sort of like God's way of giving them freeze-dried cold storage kind of a deal, you know. So if they were in time, like especially down in the desert where there's not a whole lot to eat, then they would have a midnight snack if they wanted to, which is essentially what chewing the cud is, right? It's eating food once it's already been eaten. And so this would be true of the hyrax and the rabbit as well. And it says, in the swine, verse 7, though it divides the hoof, so it's got a cloven hoof, yet having cloven hooves, yet it doesn't chew the cud, so it's unclean to you. So you can't eat pigs because they don't chew the cud. Their flesh you shall not eat, nor their carcasses you shall not touch. They are unclean to you. Now, we understand today as we look at that, as they didn't understand a lot of the health issues that would be associated with some of these restrictions back then, and we understand the trichinella worm that is found in inside the muscle tissue of swines that it's just a parasite that lives inside of them, and that through thoroughly cooking pork, you kill that and it's okay. But if it's undercooked, then major health issues. And it says, these you may eat of all that are in the water. So, okay, we're going to talk about some fish here. Whatever in the water has fins and scales, whether in the seas or in the rivers, that you may eat. But in all the seas or in the rivers that do not have, or all that are in the seas and rivers that don't have fins and scales, all that move in the water or any living thing which is in the water, they're an abomination to you. They shall be an abomination to you. You shall not eat their flesh, but you shall regard their carcasses as an abomination. Whatever in the water does not have fins and scales, that shall be an abomination to you. So you can eat any fish that have scales and if they have fins. You think, well, what about catfish? Catfish don't have scales. Yeah, that would be on the list. The fish that do not have scales are actually the scavengers of the rivers and lakes and streams. They're bottom feeders. They eat stuff that's not good, and so they were told to stay away from these. And it says, these you shall regard as an abomination among the birds, and they shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. The eagle, the vulture, and the buzzard, the kite and the falcon after its kind, every raven after its kind, the ostrich and the short-eared owl, the seagull, the hawk after its kind, little owl, fisher owl, and the screech owl. Now, some of these animals we could understand, we can recognize them, but then some of them, there's three different owls mentioned here, and they're actually three separate words in the original language. The fisher owl is probably, we even have different, there's different varieties, different species of them, but we even have the cormorant around here. Some say that it could actually be referring to a pelican. God says don't eat those. And if you've ever seen a cormorant up close, you could kind of understand why. Not all that appetizing. And then he says the white owl, the jackdaw, and the carrion vulture. The Bible doesn't have to tell me to know better than to eat vultures. I never wake up with a craving for vulture fricassee, what the heck's a jackdaw, Hebrew animal names, by the way, are more descriptive than they are defining. Say, okay, that's a dog, and we know what a dog is. A dog is a canine, and even though they come in all different shapes and sizes and smells, they're dogs, and we know what a dog is. But in Hebrew, when the names that they give to animals are oftentimes just sort of descriptive of their characteristics. And so that's why as we go through the New King James rendering of some of these animals, your version may have something different. For example, the jackdaw actually comes from the Hebrew word for vomit. This could be, the King James and the pelican, or the King James and the New American call it a pelican. The NIV calls it a desert owl, sees it as some other variety of owl. I don't know, they weren't supposed to eat them, whatever. They knew what this vomit bird was, and so they knew not to eat it. And then it says the stork, the heron after its kind, the hoopoe, and the bat. Now, the hoopoe is actually Israel's national bird, there's different varieties of them. They're primarily in the Middle East and in Africa, you understand, if you've ever been around a bird of any kind, I mean, from a sparrow to a chicken, any kind of bird whatsoever, they're pretty nasty animals. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, Heather, they are, you know. I mean, just clean out their cage once in a while, and you understand what I'm saying. But the hoopoe is kind of like on the nastyometer, you know, where you would put Heather's birds on the very, you know, clean side of it. The hoopoe is on the very opposite extreme. I mean, these are the foulest of all the fowls. Okay, and the Arabs back in the Bible times had this belief that there was some sort of healing quality to them. I don't know if you had to eat them, rub them on yourself, smell them, or they just kind of flew over you, and you know, the bird of paradise did. You know, I don't know, but they considered them to. They called them the doctor birds. And I, you know, if you've been upset over any of these restrictions so far, you think, man, how come I can't eat jackdaws? You know, they just look so appetizing to me. And then you come and he says, and don't eat bats. You know, I mean, I know, you know, is God a cosmic killjoy or what? You know, and you say, oh, man, I can't even eat bats. You know, why does that have to be in there? That's my question. I mean, why does God have to tell anybody not to eat bats? I guess because he knows us. You know, he knows human nature. And then he starts talking about flying insects and stuff in verse 20. He says, all flying insects that creep on all fours shall be an abomination to you. Now, if you got the old King James, instead of flying insects, it's the word fowl. It says the fowls, some of the versions of it use that word anyway. And it comes from a Hebrew word that just simply means to fly. And so we're not sure what kind of a critter it is, but it's something that flies. And flying insects is the way most modern versions render it. And it says, and if it walks around on all fours, you know, if you got a four-legged flying, I don't know how many birds have four legs, how many fowls have four legs, but if you have a four-legged flying something or another that crawls around on all fours, you can't eat that. Yet these you may eat of every flying insect that creeps around on all fours. We got to read this carefully because you got to understand, I mean, this is important, okay? This tells you what kind of flying thing that you can eat. Those which have jointed legs above their feet, which leap onto the earth. Does that mean that you then cannot eat ones that have legs below their feet? You know, I'm not real sure what, you know, I think what it's saying, because it kind of qualifies it here, where it says, which leap on the earth. I think it's talking about not having legs below their feet, because everything has our feet below their legs. Every animal that has feet, it's going to be below their legs. But if you look at a locust or a grasshopper, those kind of that have the jointed legs that extend up the joint, the knee version of it is above the thorax, you know, and so the legs are above its feet. I think that's what it's trying to say. If it's got those back jumping jointed legs, then that's okay. So if you're really bummed out about the whole bat prohibition, you know, yet of these you may eat of every flying insect that creeps on all fours, which have jointed legs above their feet. So, you know, you can have some grasshopper on a stick if you want to. And these you may eat, the locust after its kind, destroying locusts after its kind, the cricket after its kind. So get some dried or roasted cricket. Salted is probably preferable. And then the grasshopper after its kind. But all the other flying insects which have 4 feet, they're abominable. Verse 24 talks about different kinds of unclean animals, and it says, by these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches the carcass of any of them shall be unclean until evening. Now, remember, the Hebrews began their day. You know, we divide our day either from midnight to midnight or from sunup to sunup. You know, that's a new day to us. But to the Hebrews, the new day started at sundown. That's the beginning of their new day. So he says, you shall be clean until evening. It's like the same thing we would say, you'll be unclean. You'll be unclean until morning. You know, don't do anything. You can't do this until in the morning, until the new day starts, is what he's saying. And these, whoever carries part of the carcass with them, shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. The carcass of any animal which divides the foot but is not cloven-hoofed or does not chew the cud is unclean to you. Everyone who touches it shall be unclean. So simply eating them was not only the prohibition, but you couldn't even touch the carcass of a dead one. And when it talks about clean and unclean here, we got to understand this is not a spiritual designation. This has nothing to do with a person's walk, has nothing to do with a person's relationship or the way that they would walk before God. It has nothing to do with spirituality. It's a ceremonial cleansing that provides spiritual truth. And so he says, the carcass of any of these animals, if you touch it, you're going to be unclean. Verse 27, whatever goes on its paws among all kinds of animals, that which goes on all fours, these are unclean to you. Whoever touches such a carcass shall be unclean until evening. And whoever touches any such carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. It's unclean to you. So I think the point that he's making here, and this is pretty a good point for us to learn as well, the spiritual application of this is that if something's unclean and you touch it, you become unclean. You know, clean touching unclean does not make the unclean clean, but clean touching unclean makes the clean unclean. That's a spiritual. In fact, the only exception that we see in all of creation is Jesus touching lepers that we'll get to later. And these also shall be unclean to you among the creeping things that creep on the earth. The mole, okay, don't eat moles. The mouse, the large lizard after its kind, the gecko, the monitor lizard. I kind of thought they were large lizards myself. The sand reptile, the sand lizard, and the chameleon, these are unclean to you among all that creep, because they don't chew their cuds or have cloven hooves. Whoever touches them when they are dead shall be unclean until evening. So if you're walking along, you step on a dead lizard of some kind, you got to go through the process. And anything on which any of them falls when they are dead, they shall be unclean. Whether there is an item of wood or clothing or skin or sack, whatever item it is, in which any work is done, it must be put in water, and it shall be unclean until evening. Therefore, it shall be clean. So, you know, if you've got a gecko up in your ceiling eating all the other critters that you don't want in your house, and it's a nice gecko, and you're kind of glad to have him because he keeps the mosquitoes down, but he dies and falls down into your cooking pot, then your cooking pot just became unclean. And it says, verse 33, any earthen vessel into which any of them falls, you shall break, and whatever is in it shall be unclean. In such a vessel, any edible food upon which the water falls shall become unclean, and any drink that may be drunk from it becomes unclean. So if it falls into your cooking pot and you've just started boiling some water, then the water is unclean, and you got to take care of it. Nevertheless, a spring or a cistern in which there is plenty of water shall be clean. Whatever touches such a carcass becomes unclean. So if your lizard falls into your stream, that's okay, you know, because it's running water and it kind of self-cleansing. But then God, showing his grace here, says if it falls into a cistern, because cisterns are huge. You know, if you've ever gone to Israel and you see some of the cisterns that they've excavated, they would have tens of thousands of gallons of water in them. And water is a pretty rare commodity, especially back in those days. And so, how can you throw out the water of a cistern? You know, and so he says, that's okay. But if anything that it touches that's in the water of the stream or the cistern, then that becomes unclean. And verse 37, if any part of any such carcass falls on any planting seed which is to be sown, it remains clean. So if it falls on your wheat seed, you know, you're getting ready to sow your wheat and you got your seed there and a dead chameleon falls in it. Well, as long as the seed hasn't germinated, as long as it's still in the shell, then it doesn't become clean. But if water is put on the seed and any part of such carcass falls on it, then it becomes unclean to you. Because once the water has been put on it, then it begins the germination process. And rather than trying to determine how far along in the germination process it is, it just says, well, if it's gotten wet, then just assume it's been germinated, and so it would become unclean. And if any animal of which you eat dies, he who touches its carcass shall be unclean until evening. He who eats of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean till evening. And he who carries the carcass, same thing. And every creeping thing which creeps on the earth shall be an abomination. It shall not be eaten. whatever crawls on its belly, whatever goes on all fours, whatever has many feet among the creeping things that creep on the earth, these you shall eat, for they're an abomination. You shall not make yourselves abominable with any creeping thing that creeps, nor shall you make yourselves unclean with them, lest you become defiled by them. For I am the Lord your God. Therefore you shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth, for I am the Lord, which brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. Therefore, be holy, for I am holy. Now, we got to understand, when Peter had that vision in Acts chapter 10, he was up on the house of the roof of Simon the Tanner. It's about lunchtime, and he falls into this trance, starts having this vision. And in this vision, this sheet descends from heaven, and it's full of all kinds of different kinds of animals. Now, it's just not talking about pigs or non-kosher meat, you know, hot dogs that aren't Hebrew national hot dogs. You know, not just simply talking about that sort of thing. It's talking about, I mean, this sheet was full of all kinds of critters. You know, I mean, there would have been different kinds of bugs and snakes and reptiles and peccary and, I mean, just, you know, giraffes and just anything you could think of was inside this sheet. And then the Lord says to Pete, go eat some of that. And you know, we sometimes say, Peter, what were you thinking telling God no? But you got to understand, Peter was a very strict observant Jew. He'd never gotten near any of these things before, much less contemplated eating them. I mean, that was a very stark affront to his very nature as a good observing Jew. But this was the extent of what God was trying to show to him. What I have cleansed, let no man call unclean. And this is the law of the animals and the birds and every living creature that moves in the waters and every creature that creeps on the earth, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean, and between the animal which can be eaten and that which can't. So as I said, chapter 11 talks about the things that would cause you to be ceremonially unclean because of what you did, what you would eat, touch, and so forth. Chapter 12 talks about that which would render you to be ceremonially unclean based upon who you are as a human being. We can think of it this way. The type that's associated here. Chapter 11 talks about as sinners, is talking about the things that sinners would do that identifies them as being sinners because they did this. Where chapter 12 talks about the things that would identify you as a sinner, not based upon what you did, but just simply the fact that you're a descendant of Abraham or of Adam. And then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a woman has conceived and born a male child, that she shall become unclean 7 days, and in the days of her customary impurity shall become unclean. So if a woman has a baby, she's going to be unclean for a period of 7 days, and same is true as she has her customary impurity or her menstrual cycle. But then on the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin, you know, she has a man-child, a baby boy, on the 8th day, he's to be circumcised. And she shall continue in the blood of her purification 33 days, and she shall not touch any hallowed thing nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are fulfilled. If she bears a female child, she's got a baby girl, then she'll be unclean for 2 weeks as her customary impurity, and she'll continue in the blood of her purification 66 days. So a total of these would be, if you ended up having a baby boy, the woman would be unclean. The woman would be unclean for 40 days, and if she had a baby girl, she would be unclean twice as long for 80 days. And you think, well, first of all, why would the woman be considered to be unclean? I mean, what's wrong with having babies? And second of all, how come the girls made it more unclean longer than the boys? You know, I mean, is this some sort of a sexist thing or what? Well, let's take the first question first, because I know the answer to that one, and that is because this was to serve as an eternal reminder to the women that they were bringing forth a sinner into the world. You know, again, this clean and unclean has nothing to do with spirituality. It has nothing to do with spiritual standing before God. It's a ceremonial thing. Any time a woman would have a child, it was a reminder to them, okay, you've just procreated sinful humanity. You know, you brought somebody else into the world that's going to do some bad stuff, is the reminder that's given to her here. Now, why the boys more than the girls? I don't have any idea. Commentators take shots at it, but they're just, it's a shotgun in the dark with their eyes blind, folded. You know, they don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. With a lot of these sayings, like, for example, the trichinella worm that you find in pigs, we have learned later through science why the practical reason of that prohibition, how the rabbit chews its cud. Doesn't choose its cud, it chews its cud. And we understand that is, the science behind that we figured out at some point. We may at some point figure out why this is, why 80 days for the boys, 40 days for the girls, if God chooses to not choose, but choose to tell us, then we'll know someday. And when the days of her purification are fulfilled, whether for a son or a daughter, she shall bring to the priest a lamb of the first year as a burnt offering, a young pigeon or a turtle dove as a sin offering to the door of the tabernacle meeting. And then he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her, and she shall be clean from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who has borne a male or a female. You know, this is the idea, this whole idea, reminder that you're bringing a sinner in the world. This is brought out very, I think, succinctly in Psalm 51. Remember David's penitent psalm after he had been busted for his sin with Bathsheba. And he writes in Psalm 51, verse 5, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, in sin my mother conceived me." And this had nothing to do with what David's mom did. You know, he's not saying she was a sinner when she conceived me. It's all my mom's fault. He's not saying that. He's just recognizing the fact that when I was conceived in my mother's womb, I was a sinner. In sin did my mother conceive me. And David would understand this very clearly. Now, there's a lot about the circumcision on the eighth day that can be explained medically. We saw about the day of new beginnings. We saw that last week, and that plays into it, I'm sure. But then also the vitamin K clotting factor that is at its highest point at 8 days and so forth. There's a lot of medical reasons associated with it as well. It says in verse 8, if she's not able to bring a lamb, then she may bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons. One is a burnt offering, the other is a sin offering. So if she doesn't have a lamb, you know, it says bring a lamb and then for the burnt offering and then bring the birds as a sin offering. But if you can't do that, then bring two birds. So the priest shall make atonement for her and she shall be clean. In Luke chapter 2, we learn that when Mary had completed her days of impurity after, the first 7 days, then she brought Jesus into the temple to be circumcised and be presented before the priest. And it says that her and Joseph offered the two turtle doves, the two pigeons, then because they were indicating that they were a poor family and they couldn't afford the lamb. And, it could beg the question then, well, what if somebody who could afford a lamb decided that he would bring a turtle dove instead? You just go to the priest and say, I've had some hard knocks this week and I just don't have anything left over. Cable bill came, and I was 2 months behind and just kind of the way it is. Could a rich person do that? Well, yeah, of course they could. Would it be accepted by God, though, is the question, and this was a provision for poor people, not for people that are later in their cable bill. Chapter 13 is going to deal with, in fact, the next few chapters are going to deal with the issue of leprosy. And according to the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the ISBE, it defines leprosy, the word is sa'arat, and it defines it as a slowly progressing and intractable disease characterized by subcutaneous nodules, scabs, or cuticular crust. And white shining spots appear to be deeper than the skin. Today it's known as Hansen's disease. It doesn't officially go by leprosy anymore, but it was that's what it was called back then. And even though, as we're going to see, Leviticus deals with a lot of different dermatological and skin maladies that would not fall under the category of Hansen's disease, it's kind of the word leprosy was kind of a catch-all term for anything from zits to psoriasis to elephantiasis, that's the definition, the ISBE's definition of the Hansen's disease. McClear's Bible Handbook says this: leprosy was the quote outward invisible sign of the innermost spiritual corruption, a meet or fitting emblem in its small beginnings, its gradual spread, its internal disfigurement. It's dissolution little by little of the whole body of that which corrupts, degrades, and defiles man's inner nature and renders him unmeet or uneligible, improper, unacceptable to meet, to enter the presence of a pure and holy God. We're probably all familiar with Old and New Testament alike that deals with the subject of leprosy as a type of sin. And there's probably not anything that we could find that would serve as a better type or a better symbol of sin. It has nothing to do in the same way that a woman was not spiritually unclean just simply because she gave birth, but there was a ceremonial uncleanness here that was making a spiritual point. There's nothing that would be spiritually unclean if somebody had leprosy. It had nothing to do with that. Doesn't mean that lepers were sinners, but it just takes Hansen's disease and shows it as in so many ways of being a very apt type or symbol of sin in both the Old and the New Testament. Here's just a few. You maybe even come up with some on your own. But number one, it's initially just considered a surface condition. You know, when guys would first, and we'll see as God's showing how to diagnose it, you know, it starts off just looking like a little red spot or a rash or a hive or something, you know, is it? And you see that, somebody says, "What's that on your leg?" I said, "Oh, it's nothing, you know, just, I think I scratched myself too hard last night or something, you know, and just, I scratched my calf and this..." You know, and so it's initially not seen as what it is, and of course sin is that way, isn't it? It's actually what the Bible says, pleasurable for a season. Secondly, don't know what causes it. You know, there's an unseen cause. There's nothing that's really we can't really automatically inherently understand why people do the things that they do. We understand that it's a result of the sin nature, but it's an unseen kind of thing. It's not something that you can look at under a microscope and say, "Oh, this is why somebody's a sinner." And this is true of leprosy. Number three, it isolates. As we're going to see, it would isolate initially when you would be put into quarantine, but then it also would, once you had been diagnosed with it, it would isolate you permanently, and it would separate you from friends and family. And of course, sin very much does that, doesn't it? And then number four, it spreads. You know, it never just stays this red spot on your calf. You know, you think that's all it is, but then one of the telltale signs that it's more than that is when you begin to see it spread. And that's the way sin is. You know, we leave that door open for Satan to come in and just kind of have his way in a certain element, certain part of our lives. And then it's not satisfied with staying there. You know, sin will begin spreading and start manifesting itself in other areas of our lives as well. And one of the major things about Hansen's disease, for many years, in fact, not until the 20th century, in my lifetime, was it discovered that it used to be thought of as the rotting disease. It was because, and in fact, you can even read some of the old descriptions that says, well, what Hansen's disease does is it causes your extremities to rot. And that's not true. That's not really what it does. What it does is it causes insensitivity. You lose the feeling in your extremities, and you don't feel anymore. And it starts in your extremities, maybe your fingers and your toes, and then begins spreading throughout your body. You lose sensitivity in your eyes and your nose and ears, and so if you get injured, you don't know that you've injured yourself, and so then that injury would become infected, or in many cases, gangrenous, and the associated rotting that would take place of that would cause the limbs to fall off. And you can see many pictures of lepers that have no fingers left, and sometimes no hands and feet. And then the next thing is that it leads to blindness, and so does sin. Doesn't it do that? Because you would forget, if you had leprosy, you would forget, you'd lose the sensitivity of your eyes, and so you'd forget to blink. And so they would not blink for days upon days upon days. Their eyes would dry out, and they would become blind. And then it oftentimes leads to a loss of hearing, because the same sort of thing. You lose the sensitivity in your ears. You'll get some sort of infection and not know it, and then you end up. And sin does that, doesn't it? You know, maybe in the early stages, if somebody, brother or sister, were those of us who are spiritual would come to us and try to restore us in a spirit of meekness. We would have ears to hear. But then after we've become very entrenched in this, you know, it's like, you stop dredging me, brother, kind of a thing, because we become insensitive to hearing. And as we look at these descriptions, as I say, it's going to cover the whole spectrum from psoriasis to burns, and from pimples to the actual Hansen's disease. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When a man has a skin of his on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, and it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, then he shall be brought to Aaron the priest, or to one of his sons the priest, and the priest shall examine the sore on the skin of the body, and if the hair on the sore has turned white, the sore appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is a leprous sore, and the priest shall examine him and pronounce him unclean." So it was not just simply, you know, it says that it appears to be deeper than the surface of the skin. Sin is not just simply a surface issue. You know, it goes beyond skin deep. It goes down to our very heart. And the term unclean in chapters 13 to 15, dealing with clean and unclean stuff, the word unclean appears 54 times. So that's definitely God's emphasis right now, that which will make us unclean. It says, "But if the bright spot is white on the skin of his body and does not appear to be deeper than the skin, and its hair is not turned white, then the priest shall isolate that one who has the sore 7 days." Going to put him in quarantine for 7 days. "And he shall examine him on the seventh day, and indeed if the sore appears to be as it was, the sore is not spread on the skin, then the priest shall isolate him another 7 days. And the priest shall examine him again on the seventh day, and indeed if the sore has faded, and the sore has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It's only a scab. And he shall wash his clothes and be clean. But if the scab should at all spread over the skin, after he has been seen by the priest for his cleansing, he shall be seen by the priest again. And if the priest sees that the scab has indeed spread over on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It's leprosy." You know, throughout this passage, something that I want you to notice, one of the emphasis that he has on its identification is its spreading. And, of course, as a type of sin, that works pretty aptly. And then verse 9, "When the leprous sore is on a person, then he shall be brought to the priest, and the priest shall examine him. And indeed, if the swelling on his skin is white, he's turned his hair white, and there's a spot of raw flesh in the swelling, it's an old leprosy on the skin of the body, and the priest shall pronounce him unclean and shall not isolate him because he's unclean. And if leprosy breaks out all over the skin and the leprosy covers all of the skin of the one who has a sore from his head to his foot, wherever the priest looks, then the priest shall consider, and indeed if leprosy has covered his body, pronounce him unclean who has a sore. It has all turned white and he is clean." When the raw flesh appears on him, he shall be unclean, and the priest shall examine the raw flesh and pronounce him to be unclean, for the raw flesh is unclean, it's leprosy. Or if the raw flesh changes and turns white again, he shall come to the priest, and the priest shall examine him, and indeed, if sores turn white, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean, him clean who has the sore, or he is clean. Now, what follows is going to be dealing with a lot of things that aren't Hansen's disease now, but it's just kind of showing some of the other skin diseases as a ceremonial uncleansing. And this is going to deal with, verses 18 to 23 deal with things, the result of boils. "If the body develops a boil in the skin and it's healed, in the place of the boil there comes a white swelling or a bright spot, reddish white, then it shall be shown to the priest. And if, when the priest sees it, it indeed appears to be deeper than the skin and its hairs has turned white, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It's a leprous sore which has broken out of the boil. But if the priest examines it, and indeed there are no white hairs in it, and it's not deeper than the skin, but it's faded, then the priest shall isolate it, lay him 7 days. And if it should spread over the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It's a leprous sore. And it has not spread. It is the scar of the boil, and the Lord shall pronounce him clean." The next five verses deal with the skin issues that would be the result of burns. It says, "If the body receives a burn on its skin by fire, and the raw flesh of the burn becomes a bright spot, reddish white or white, then the priest shall examine it, and indeed, if the hair of the bright spot is turned white and appears to be deeper in the skin, it is leprosy broken out on the burn. Therefore, the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It's a leprous sore. But if the priest examines it, and indeed there are no white hairs on the bright spot, it's not deeper than the skin, but it's faded, then he will isolate him 7 days, and the priest shall examine him on the seventh day, and if it's spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a leprous sore. But if the white spot stays in one place and is not spread on the skin, but is faded, it is a swelling from the burn. You know, he's just got an infection from the burn, is what he's saying. Then the priest shall pronounce him clean for the scar. It is the scar of the burn. And then verse 29, this is kind of a cool verse. This is pretty important. If the man or a woman has a sore on the head or the beard. So, you know, whether it's a man or a woman, if they've got a sore on their beard, then you need to take heed. And I think the reason why he's bringing this up here about having the sore, you know, get sore on the skin, then you got the sore on the hair, is because the sores in the hair or in her beard might not quite be as obvious at first glance. You know, you might have to kind of look a little closer, you know, pull the hairs apart and look in. And then the priest shall examine the sore. Indeed, if it appears deeper on the skin and there is in it thin yellow hair, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean, or her, as the case may be. It's a scaly leprosy of the hair or beard. And if the priest examines the scaly sore, and indeed it does not appear deeper in the skin, and there's no black hair in it, then the priest shall isolate the one who has the scale 7 days. Now, if you got the Old King James, as we've been going through this, the scaly sore is translated the plague of the skull. You know, just if that happens to you, you've got the plague of the skull. And on the seventh day, the priest shall examine the sore. And indeed, if the scale has not spread and there's no yellow hair in it, then the skull does not appear deeper than the skin. He shall shave himself, but the scale he shall not shave. You know, so if you've got this like spot on the side of your face that's scaly, if you've got the scale of the skull, then you just shave around that and leave that part there. And the priest shall isolate the one who has the scale another 7 days. And on the seventh day, the priest shall examine the scale. And indeed, if the scale has not spread over the skin and does not appear deeper than the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. Wash his clothes and be clean. But if the scale should at all spread over the skin after his cleansing, then the priest shall examine him. And indeed, if the scale is spread over the skin, the priest need not seek for yellow hair. He's unclean. And if the scale appears to be at a standstill, and there is black hair grown up in it, the scale has healed. He is clean, and the priest shall pronounce him clean. If a man or woman has bright spots on the scale of the body, specifically white bright spots, then the priest shall look, and indeed, if the bright spots of the skin of the body are dull white, it's a white spot that grows on the skin. You know, we all get those. For the man, I like this. As for the man whose hair has fallen from his head, he's bald, but he's clean. He whose hair has fallen from his forehead, he is bald on the forehead, but he's unclean. You know, he's talking about male pattern baldness. The old King James said, if he's forehead bald, you know, he's clean. I've read over this verse many, many years and many, many times, and just kind of, you made some jokes about it and everything, but I just, you know, in the last few years, I've been noticing my hairline, you know, it's just like, I mean, it's making this really big race to the back of my melon, and so I kind of read through this time with a kind of a renewed interest. And if there is on the bald head or a bald forehead a reddish-white sore, then it's a leprosy breaking out on his bald head or his bald forehead. And then the priest shall examine it, and indeed, if the swelling of the sore is reddish-white on his bald head or his bald forehead, as the appearance of leprosy on the skin of the body, then he's a leprous man. He's unclean, and the priest shall surely pronounce him unclean. The sore is on his head. Now the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn, his head bare. Obviously, he's bald. And he shall cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. You know, he says cover his mustache. The idea of that is you're going to put your hand over your mouth. You know, you don't put it over your beard. Your hand over your beard, you put it over your mustache so that it's covering your mouth. And then wherever you go, you cry, unclean, unclean. And he shall be unclean. All the days he has the sore, he shall be unclean. He's unclean, and he shall dwell alone, and the dwelling shall be outside the camp. As we saw, one of the major elements of leprosy is that you would be isolated, and you couldn't live inside the city. You couldn't live inside the camp. You'd have to be isolated, and that's what sin does. And then it's going to talk about, you know, when your threads get leprosy. So obviously this is you know, talking about some kind of mold or something like that. But it says, also, if a government, well, governments get leprosy, but this is talking about your garment. If a garment has a leprous plague in it, whether it's a woolen garment or a linen garment, whether it's in the warp or the woof of linen or wool, then whether in leather or anything made of leather, if the plague is greenish or reddish in the garment or in the leather, whether it's the warp or the woof or in anything made of leather, it's a leprous plague and shall be shown to the priest. And the priest shall examine the plague, isolate that which has the plague 7 days. And he shall examine the plague on the seventh day. And if the plague is spread in the garment, either in the warp or the woof, or in the leather or anything made of leather, the plague is an active leprosy. It is unclean. You know, it could just be where the guy spilled his coffee, and so you got this stain. So, okay, well, we're going to make sure. We're going to put your coat in quarantine, and we'll check it out in 7 days. And he shall therefore burn that garment in which is the plague, whether warp or woof, in wool or linen, anything of leather, for it's an active leprosy, and that garment shall be burned in fire. Now, if you're not familiar with the terms warp and woof, you know, we don't do a whole lot of loom working these days. We don't do a whole lot of that. But the warp, if you have any kind of a woven garment, the warp are the vertical threads that go up and down, and then the woof would be the horizontal threads that go side to side. And so if you've got this stain, this leprous sore in the garment, regardless of whether it's the up and down part or the back and forth part, it's unclean. But if the priest examines it, and indeed the plague has not spread in the garment, either the warp or the woof, or in anything made of leather, then the priest shall command that they wash the thing in which is the plague, and shall isolate it another 7 days. You know, you just spilled coffee, wash it, let's see what happens. And then the priest shall examine the plague after it's been washed, and indeed, if the plague has not changed its color, though the plague has not spread, it is unclean, and you shall burn it in the fire. It continues eating away whether the damage is outside or inside. If the priest examines it, and indeed the plague has faded after washing it, then he shall tear it out of the garment, whether out of the warp or out of the woof or out of the leather. If it appears again in the garment, either in the warp or in the woof or anything made of leather, it's a spreading plague, and you shall burn it with fire, which is in the plague. And then you shall wash the garment, either the warp or woof, or whatever is made of leather. If the plague has disappeared from it, then it shall be washed a second time, and shall be clean. This is the law of the leprous plague in a garment of wool or linen, either the warp or the woof, or anything made of leather, to pronounce it clean or to pronounce it unclean. So we could ask ourselves, okay, we understand that there is this thing called leprosy. Why is the Bible using this kind of a catch-all term? I mean, it's going to, you know, he's going to talk later about if your house gets leprosy, you know, why not be more specific? Why not use the term mold or psoriasis or something like that? And it's because of the typology, you know, and as he's talking about, if you got your duds become leprous, then you need to cut it out. You need to do away with it. And I think that the spiritual application here is Isaiah 64, verse 6 says, all of our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. And so, you know, this speaks to our appearance as we go out and people see us. What do they see? You know, do they see righteousness in our lives, or do they see the stain of sin? And so, you know, this isn't talking about some sort of a specificity regarding garments as far as whether they're good or bad, but the spiritual application is that this is, you know, what the people would present before the world, is they are to be separate from the rest of the world, and the world should see them as being so. Let's pray. God, there would be a whole lot of this that we could pass over and just see it as being very unapplicable to us today. We're not under those kind of restrictions. We aren't told what we can and can't eat. We're just told to do it to the glory of God. But in that is the rub, Lord, and that's the whole issue of why studying these passages are important to us, because we know that we are not our own. We've been bought with a price. And therefore, whatever we do, whether it be the things that we do in the body or out of the body, the things that we take in or the things that we wear, whatever we do, that we are to demonstrate to the world, to our own brothers and sisters, and before the host of heaven, that we are your people, that we have been set apart by you for your purposes. We are not our own, God. We've been bought with a price. And may that lesson, Lord, be learned by us. May it be owned by us. And may it be reflected in the things that we say and do. Just as James exhorted the early Gentiles to live separate lives, God, may we do the same. That so when the world would look at us, they wouldn't see the filth and the defilement and the corruption and the spreading scale of sinfulness, but they would see Jesus. And we ask that in his holy and precious name. Amen.